This edition of COVID Race and Democracy is the third and final part of our series on imperialism, which is the highest stage of capitalism.
We do not immigrate from Mexico across the border into the United States. We migrate.
Inside the United States, social movements by African American, Chicano, Mexicano, and Asian communities are connected to international struggles to resist exploitation of people, resources, and land.
COVID is exposing the most vengeful ills of what this country represents and what's going on in the world.
Continued state violence against Black and Brown communities in the U.S. reinforced the notion that these Americans are internally colonized people.
Anti-imperialism was fundamental to the establishment of the so-called Asian American movement.
And despite this ongoing repression inside the U.S. and around the world, the legacy of anti-imperialist analysis and activism is like a beacon shining brightly for humanity. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID Race and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Network and radio affiliates. I'm your host, Esther Ivarum. And we're going to launch this third and final installment of our series on imperialism by exploring resistance struggles inside the United States. The U.S. arrested 200,000 people at the southern border in July, the highest monthly total in this century. But who are the real illegal aliens in this settler colonial nation, which was built on the land stolen from indigenous and Mexican people? That's a question that is never addressed on corporate media or in the narrowly constricted debates between Republicans and Democrats. As we mark the 51st anniversary of the Chicano moratorium against the Vietnam War, there is much to learn from the Chicano-Mexicano liberation movement. It has long challenged the dominant narrative about U.S. invasions and occupations, both here and throughout the world. Ricardo Romero was one of the founders of the Chicano-Mexicano movement in the 1960s and 70s. He's been an activist for more than 50 years as a leading anti-imperialist voice for Chicano-Mexicano liberation and global solidarity. Ricardo Romero had this conversation from Greeley, Colorado, with Pacifica producer Ken Yale.
My name is Ricardo Romero. I've been a community organizer the last 51 years, and I was one of the co-founders of the Crusade for Justice in 1966. I was also one of the founders of the Mexican National Liberation Movement in 1979. Those are the two highlights of my life, my involvement in the Chicano-Mexicano movement, and continuing all these years trying to affect some change for the betterment of humanity.
Okay, let me ask you about that term, why you choose to identify yourself as Chicano-Mexicano.
Well, what it means to me is that we are really a Mexican people living in occupied Mexico, with a militarily imposed border. And I think most people don't realize that the seven states, Colorado, Nuevo Mexico, Texas, Arizona, California, Nevada, and Utah, were all part of the Mexican nation. And when you study any type of history in terms of the Mexican-American War, they always say the United States annexed. They did not annex this land. They conquered it. They declared war on us in 1846, terminating in 1848 with the signing of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. And I think it's important to understand the whole question of a militarily imposed border, because then we have to address the question of settler colonialism for the Chicano-Mexicanos in the United States.
Let's go deeper into that, because the issue of migration and immigration across this U.S.-Mexico border that, as you point out, has been militarily imposed, in the mainstream debate, it's framed in ways that just accept the legitimacy of the border and the right of the U.S. to prevent Mexicans and others from entering this country. But you mentioned several organizations that have challenged that narrative that you've been a part of. You were a leader in the Crusade for Justice, which hosted the Chicano Youth Liberation Conference in 1969. And I believe that's where the concept of Aztlan was first popularized. So what can we learn from the Chicano Mexicano movements about this issue of migration, immigration, and the border?
Well, beginning in middle 60s and 65, 66, 67, there was a whole coming together of the beginning aspects of the Chicano movement. And I think what's really important was that for the first time, we were starting to address the question of national identity and who we were. And we were not recognized by the United States government, and we did not feel that the United States government ever lived up to any of their treaty rights with us. But that wasn't surprising because they never lived up to any treaty they ever signed with the indigenous people. I think in 1968-69, the first Chicano Youth Liberation Conference, when the question of Aztlan was raised, it was a call for nationhood, an indigenous nation in the Americas. And I agree with the whole concept that we were an indigenous people to the Americas. And therefore, we do not immigrate from Mexico across the border into the United States. We migrate. We come from the Americas. The immigrants were the Europeans and other people who had to cross oceans and immigrated to come here. And we're not immigrants. And I think we have to really start questioning that, because that's the concept that the Europeans have about us, that we're immigrants. How can we be immigrants? Our nation is divided, and half is in the north, half is in the south. And we just migrate from one part of the south to the north, or from the north to the south. And Central Americans are the same way. They come and they migrate from Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, or the Latin Americans that come. They don't immigrate. They migrate also.
You were a leader in the Crusade for Justice, which was based in Denver, and you were the head of the school. You had various programs in the community. You were very much under surveillance, and COINTELPRO was targeting the organization. So just say a little bit about what was going on in the community that you were helping to lead at that time.
Well, we were dealing with the whole question of education, police brutality, unemployment, you know, all of the issues that were burning fire in that time period. And we started Escuela Tlatelolco, and we had some attributes that were totally different than the public schools. We put forth that we wouldn't go by grades, we would go by the seven cultures of the Americas. So the first grade would be the Olmecas, the second grade would be the Mayas, the third grade would be the Teotihuacanos, the fourth grade would be the Toltecas, the fifth grade would be the Chichimecas, and the sixth grade would be the Zapoteca Mixteca, and the seventh grade would be the Nahualtlacas. And our theory was that if you started in the kindergarten and you would go through the sixth grade, you would come out of that school understanding and knowing the seven cultures of the Americas. I think the first year that we started, it may have been 1969, and we had about 220 students registered, and it was an incredible amount of work, but we had a grassroots community. I left the Crusade in 1974, but the school was, to me, the most essential thing we ever did.
And then you went on to help found the Movimiento de Liberación Nacional Mexicano, the Mexican National Liberation Movement. And at that point, the organization first put out the concept of the socialist reunification of Mexico. So can you talk a little bit about what that strategy is and why that was the next step?
Well, I think we came together. In 1973, we went to Mexico City, and we ran into Mario Cantu, and he was really elated to see us and said, I got a guerrilla group here in Mexico that has taken over land outside of Mexico City in Cuernavaca, and he says, I'm going up to meet with him, and so you could come with us. We went to Cuernavaca, and we went to Villa de las Flores, where there was a land occupation by peasants. in the land of Villa de las Flores belonged to the governor of Morelos' son. So we got to meet Florencio Güero Medrano. They had already built about 400 homes out of tin, cardboard, whatever they could get their hands on. And they were working on a clinic, and they had their street names and their Avenida Ho Chi Minh and Centro Che Guevara. And it was just a mind-blowing experience for us. And in our discussions, Güero Medrano raised the question. He said, well, you know, Mexico's no different than Vietnam. And I said, well, how so? And he says, well, it has a north and a south to it. In Vietnam, the north is liberated and the south is the occupied territories. And he said, in Mexico, in the south is a dependent capitalist state and the north is occupied. And that just kind of blew us away, because we had never, ever had that concept of the border and the military and strategically what it meant for the United States. And in 1978, we formed the Mexican National Liberation Movement. And the MLN's position was always, que se vengan a la brava, just come and cross the border. Why do you need papers to come back into your own land? And we continued to see how it was that we could try and create this movement around a socialist reunification of Mexico.
I was born the son of the Aztlan Nation, refused to live on the reservation. They keep me down because my color is brown, but now the time has come to turn it all around. My heart is here like the blood of a Mayan king. Speech clear so you can hear the sound I bring. Sounds like a tribe, it cannot claim me. Brothers of my color, man, they wanted to spray me. Back in the hood when we used to rumble, but those days are gone, I'm gonna be humble. Like an Aztec, I'm mystic, I'm fierce like a lion. Make it or break it, cause I'm descended from mine. But now I'm living in the USA, and the government wishes I'd just go away. But I didn't cross the border crossed me. Now I'm living in the land of the free. Freedom of speech and the right to bear arms. If I do it, then I'm out to do harm. They wanna lock me up because I'm frightening. Give me the chance, and I'll strike like lightning. I wrote this rhyme for mi raza. Oye, que tal? Dime que pasa. Tengo una cosa que quiero decir. And this is one thing you all need to hear. Why's it gotta be that brown strikes fear? If you ask me, we're the first ones here. But it's hard to live your life by the tribal law, when your culture is destroyed by the mechanical claw of an invisible machine in an occupied territory. Now they telling us that we're the minority. That's bull. I ain't with it, so we laid a dope crack, so I can hit it. I got science, like a scientist, mesmerized and hypnotized like a hypnotist. And now you're under my power, Chicano power. Brown fist in the air to stand tall like a tower. Like a brown beret, I'm gonna take away all your stereotypes, because I'm here to stay. Now to make the Aztlan community align. But as I drop science, I still wonder why it's getting harder to alleviate pressure put on people to assimilate.
We took on a struggle with developers from Arizona and northern New Mexico. Some of our people that were doing work there called us and said they were thinking of taking over this land that the Flores family had occupied for 20-some years. I told them, look, we will support however we can, by whatever means necessary, we will support the land occupation. But if anything is won, then it has to belong to the people. And the people are the ones that have to be able to make the decisions of what is done with that land, or else the Mexican National Liberation Movement won't participate in it. Amado Flores agreed, his father agreed, a lot of the elders agreed. Amado's put in jail, and they really harassed his family because he burned the court orders to vacate the land. And we just said, well, we're going to continue this occupation. And we were pretty shocked that they offered to give us 216 acres of the land with title to it. And we agreed. That happened in 88. And in 1989, we had the first Tierra Maria Youth Brigades. And we started the school at Tierra Maria. From the experience of Tlatelolco, we're always going to continue to somehow build a school. The Attorney General rated us as number one on the New Mexico Crime Commission list. over the drug cartels and over the human traffickers, the Mexican MLN, because of our relationship to the Puerto Rican MLN and our relationship to AIM and our relationship to the Black Liberation Movement. In 21 years, we took over 1,100 young people from California, from Texas, from Chicago, from Denver, from New Mexico. And just 3 years ago, the New Mexico Attorney General filed a case on us, and we just ended up losing that land. But we never took advantage. We never endeavored in making any profit or utilizing that land for that. It was always for education. We utilized it as best we could for as long as we could. So we know we were successful in what we were doing because the government eventually came after us again.
That's a really amazing and inspiring story, and more people need to know about it. Part of our purpose in doing this show is really to try to draw out some of the lessons from the Chicano Mexicano movement. The state and the corporate media always try to divide us into the good, peaceful activists who work within the system and then those bad, militant protesters who deserve to be demonized and repressed. And certainly the organizations and work you've done have always been about the need for systemic change, the right to self-determination, the importance of international solidarity. And because of that, you have always been subjected to repression personally and organizationally. So talk a little about that kind of attempt by the state to divide us into the good and the bad activists.
The priority is always a settler colonialist state, and it's the responsibility of every colonized subject to wage a struggle to free their land. And anything that has to do with land, that puts you in the crosshairs of imperialism. Because we put forth that Tierra Maria was the first liberated zone in occupied Mexico. And we always put that out. We put that out. And so anything that you do that you're effective, if your organization is touching a real fine nerve of the state, they have to react. They have to. Their whole effort is total control. In the 50 years I've been involved, we started out with the whole question of civil rights because we didn't understand that it was a question of human rights. Eventually, we got there. But when you get to these higher levels, then they have an apparatus that they created in the late 1950s and 60s, the counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO. And when we look back now at the Chicano-Mexicano movement, in 1972, they assassinate Ricardo Falcón on his way to the National La Raza Unida Conference. In 1973, they attacked the Crusade for Justice, the dormitories of the school where some of our teachers lived. They killed Luis Martinez, and there was a shootout with the police, and they blew up the building that Mario Vasquez was in, and they beat a lot of people that night, terrorized a lot of people. And then in 1974, they killed the Boulder Six. In 1978, maybe, Carlos Zapata was killed in a bomb explosion. So we realized late in the game that this was all part of the COINTEL program. It's important that people understand this. That's just Colorado. New Mexico, they probably have as many martyrs or maybe even more than us. California has Ruben Salazar and Angel Diaz and Lynn Ward from the first moratorium and the second moratorium. Montague, who was a Sephardic Jew and supported the Brown Berets and the Chicano movement, and he was killed. And the farm workers had like 7 or 8 people that were killed. So, you know, we've never been able to do a national push to identify the martyrs of the Chicano-Mexicano struggle, but there are many, many. And COINTELPRO uses the same strategy against everybody else, not just one group. They've used it against everybody.
But in the face of all of that repression, the price that you and others had to pay and your share of disappointments and setbacks, you've still stuck to your principles all these years. You continue to organize and inspire in your community. And I wonder what sustained you through all of that and what's giving you hope after 50 years of facing this level of repression?
Well, I think for me and for a lot of people, to do for the people, to do for our communities, to do for all people, to become internationalists, to go to prison supporting the Puerto Rican independence movement. We did it, Maria Cueto and Pedro Archuleta and myself. And it comes out of what it is that you internally believe that it's going to take to change the system. And it's not just us, and it's not just here, but it's the whole worldwide misery that people suffer and live because of this empire. So that's what's maintained me always. And I've never gave up, I'll never cave in, and I'll never quit. And I think I'm going to be able to own up to that because I'm 86 and I'm heading the other way. But we have left some young people, and there's going to be more young people. When I see and get to talk to young people, it just elates me and it just takes me to another level because that's the future and they're there. And it's not really how we have to reach them. It's how they have to internalize their own reality and see what it is they want to do. And I think that's the future I look forward to. We have a responsibility to support our youth. However we can, wherever we can, we have to do that and help them to develop a movement for social change and revolution that is valid and has validity in the future.
Well, Ricardo Romero, I hope all of our listeners have been as inspired by your insights and your commitment to the struggle over these 50 years as I have been. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Ken.
Él respetaría, y así prometiendo no colonizar como Puerto Rico, Hawái, Aztlán. Hermano chicano, no hay que decaer. Busquen tus entrañas al indio de ayer. Solo su nobleza y su humanidad te darán las fuerzas de la libertad, porque este soñar se acabó. Se está pagando el gringo opresor. Ya está temblando todo el mundo pobre, ya va marchando, cantemos hermanos al nuevo sol, cantemos hermanos al nuevo sol, cantemos hermanos al nuevo sol.
This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Esther Ivarum. Well, a year ago during the summer of 2020, the United States was in the midst of an uprising against racism after the lynching of George Floyd by the Minneapolis police and Derek Chauvin. Some people have called 2020 the most significant reckoning with racism as a component of global white supremacy and imperialism since the 1960s. Here to discuss the role of the African-American community in the fight against imperialism is the veteran activist and writer Rosemary Mealy, who was an active member of the Black Panther Party and the National Alliance of Third World Women. She's an adjunct professor at the City University of New York and author of several books, including Fidel and Malcolm X, Memories of a Meeting. Rosemary was also a regular host at WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York City. Welcome to COVID, Race, and Democracy on Pacifica, Thank Rosemary.
Thank you so much, Esther. It's great to be on your show.
Well, in the 1960s, inside the United States, the fascist system, we call it, of Jim Crow, was being dismantled as a result of the civil rights and Black power movements. And outside the United States,
liberation and anti-colonial movements were victorious throughout Africa and other parts of the globe. So as an activist working, I guess, in both periods, then and now, and in between, what are your top line thoughts about the impact of the Black liberation movement here inside the U.S. in fighting successfully against U.S. imperialism and its allies? And what have we learned?
I believe that there were quite a few struggles that allowed us in this country, particularly within the Black liberation movement, to focus more, to define our theoretical understandings of what was happening in the world. And I think that one of the most important struggles that we were engaged in as a part of the Black liberation movement was the struggles against apartheid in South Africa. And there we did have some victories that we can point to in fighting successfully against U.S. imperialism. And that was the emergence of the boycott divestment movement when longshoremen on the West Coast refused to unload cargoes from South Africa. Then we have several critical important organizations in this country that was in the forefront of leading that struggle and providing some directions to that anti-imperialist movement. Trans-Africa from DC, the African Liberation Support Committee, which was critical around May 30th. You know, there would be national celebrations with hundreds, thousands out there, say, of Black folk around the country coming together, mobilizing in support of African liberation. So I think those were battles that, you know, we were engaged in, and that I think that our movement oftentimes is not given enough credit for, because that divestment movement, it was like a sword that really bit into the side of U.S. imperialism. So I think that that was important. I also think that within the Black liberation movement, in successfully fighting against U.S. imperialism, there's a part of that movement that many of us were involved in that, again, we don't get credit for it, and that is the environmental justice movement. There's a brother, he's known as the father of environmental justice, and that's Dr. Robert Bullock, who did a lot around issues of sustainable development, particularly looking at the role of corporations. His book called Dumping in Dixie, I remember that, which came out in 2000. There was a brother who left us named Damu Smith out of D.C., who not only was an activist within the anti-apartheid movement, but Damu brought the whole issue of environmental racism and environmental justice into the Black liberation movement. I think that that's something that today we don't really link the Black liberation movement enough to the environmental justice movement or the global environmental justice movement. So those were two takeaways that I think are important. The other point being that the struggles around Pan-Africanism and how that there were various ideological strains within the Black liberation movement, but I think oftentimes we were able to coalesce with cultural nationalists. We were able to coalesce with Black Marxists. And I think those were some of the things that were important to me as an individual involved in the Black Panther Party, as well as in the National Alliance of Third World Women, which was a critical organization that brought women of color, quote unquote, together. And for some of us, this was really important because we began to understand, when people talk about intersectionality, we began to understand how, as women, women of Black women and women of color, we had a common enemy, but at the same time, we respected and recognized our differences as women. We were engaged in struggles around the Vietnam War, struggles around Puerto Rican independence, particularly aligning ourselves with Puerto Rican women who were involved in the struggles against sterilization of Puerto Rican women.
You know, I'm so glad that you mentioned Damu Smith, who was actually a producer at WPFW Pacifica Radio, and his name is raised in terms of issues around environmental justice and the anti-apartheid struggle, even moving on to Israel and recognizing that as an apartheid state. Yeah. And actually, the first subject we tackled in this series on imperialism explored how U.S. imperialism and its allies are fueling this existential crisis of the global ecosystem and climate catastrophe. And as we speak right now, there are vast portions of the U.S. on fire, and devastating floods have killed people in Germany, India, and China. And sometimes when I hear people talk about Black liberation from a purely nationalist perspective, it does sound disconnected from the environmental crisis at hand. Obviously, if we don't confront the crisis about how we're living and our habitat as humans, there will be no humanity to be liberated. And we could say the same thing about COVID-19. So can you shorthand some of your own development to think about the system of imperialism as opposed to civil rights or Black power?
Sure. And I think that fundamental to that is having an understanding of what is capitalism. We hear now about the theory of racial capitalism, but we also have to understand capitalism in its real form. And I'm not saying that that analysis does not purport to being a part of the real form. But I think for me, what was most important was being grounded in Marxism, to be blunt with you, to be open, to be transparent about that. And once having that understanding, my understanding of capitalism and studying it gave me a framework from which to engage in struggle. I mean, I often tell my students now, when people talk about the merits of capitalism, I often say to them, particularly students of African descent, how can you praise and uphold a system where Black women were producers? You know, we were the catalyst that provided the basis for the economic structure of this country through our womb. So having an understanding, a theoretical understanding of the underpinnings of capitalism and the exploitation and how its tentacles has stretched globally to be expanded to what we call imperialism. And so I think that it's important. And we hear, the anti-communism is so striking that we hear today from the mouths of Black folk who just don't seem to understand what is communism, not being able to define what it is or talking about it, and really castigating those societies that have attempted to develop along, quote unquote, a socialist model. For me, it was important to have a theoretical grounding in understanding our oppression. Where does it come from? How does it relate to social constructs in this society around issues of gender, race, class, sexuality, sexual preferences? It's important to have that kind of framework to be able to analyze what is happening now. Because as you mentioned, the whole global ecosystem and the climate catastrophe, that comes right back to global corporations who have no respect for the earth and no respect for the environment. And in this country, are having to live in spaces that are polluted. We live in cities where sanitation is not collected. You know, we live in towns where asthma, all the health hazards that our people are confronted with now, unless we have an understanding of what causes that and to whom's benefit that does that relate back to, then we find ourselves involved in this kind of struggle, a social struggle here, a social struggle around a particular issue there, and not coalescing and understanding that fundamental to all these struggles that we're engaged in, it goes right back to our having a theoretical understanding of how did we get to live in the kind of polluted and inhumane society that we live in here in the United States of America, and how that country and the politics of that country and the policies of that country have expanded globally and are impacting people globally. And that's why people are struggling.
Right. And when you were talking about being able to coalesce with different people with different ways of thinking around Black liberation, reminded me that there have always been, different strains within the Black freedom movement. And one of those strains was made up of people who wanted to shake off the chains of Jim Crow discrimination. And they wanted to just be able to assimilate within the U.S. system. And maybe they didn't really call it capitalism. Maybe they didn't really have that type of background in terms of education. But they knew that they didn't want to be poor anymore, right? They knew that they didn't want to be in the situation where they were. So to just develop and come up in society was a goal, right? But then there were other people who really understood on a different level what exactly the capitalist system is. And so between the 1960s and now, we've had the first Black president of the United States, who became really the international face of U.S. imperialism. And so what are your thoughts about the ways that the issues of race, identity, and maybe even basic survival, like I was just talking about, are being used to enlist Black people into the imperialist project? And what some people are calling woke imperialism or intersectional imperialism. I saw a cartoon where they had one U.S. warplane dropping bombs on people, and then they had another plane dropping bombs, but that one had like an LGBTQ flag and a Black Lives Matter flag on it. And so anyway, that kind of just goes to my question.
And those kinds of images are really important because you can use those images to teach, you know, exactly what we're talking about here. But, you know, I just like to back a little bit. I think one of the leading theorists for many of us and leaders for us in practice was Malcolm X. Malcolm talked about everything that you and I are talking about now. He kind of reframed this whole struggle about civil rights as being a human rights struggle. And prior to that, our whole case had gone before the United Nations with Mr. Patterson from the Communist Party and Paul Robeson taken before the United Nations. Our issues as Black people were with that important document titled We Charge Genocide. So Malcolm taught us that these different tendencies existed, you know, within our own communities. Those who would push forward and wanted to assimilate into the society, and those of us who would continue to struggle and challenge that. And so then we became so engrossed and involved in the whole democratic process that when Obama emerged, we didn't have a Black liberation movement because it had been crushed and destroyed by the counterintelligence program. So any kind of leader emerging during that time that reflected socially who we were as a people, you know, we gravitated to that. And I understand that piece. And that was important. But on another level, we had to be critical of him. We were critical of him. His foreign policy was the foreign policy that had been carried on by this country for centuries. You know, it just been kind of mellowed down and tinkered with a bit to make it look like it was what it really wasn't. So yes, and we will continue to have, I mean, now we have a Black woman who is the vice president, right? And her, I mean, should I say more? I mean, the policies that are emerging, the domestic issues, the international issues that are emerging at this moment, where she represents the face of U.S. imperialism. And there are Black folks who would be critical of me saying that, but that's true. And then the expectation is that we will be silent and prop up the system, prop it up. You know, we can't even get a voting rights bill passed, you know. But right. At the same time, it's just amazing what's going on at this particular period in the midst of COVID, where COVID is exposing the most vengeful ills of what this country represents and what's going on in the world. And that's why it's important to have a movement that will emerge. And I'm saying that will emerge, that is clear about this, you know, because we have to struggle on all fronts.
So the last thing I want to talk about is the fact that, you know, so many of the African liberation movements from the 60s were destroyed by the CIA or CIA cutouts. And in this century, there was a marriage between like Pan-Africanism and anti-imperialism, I believe, in Libya, in terms of the having the highest standard of living really on the African continent. Muammar Gaddafi, of course, was assassinated during the US-NATO invasion of that country. And now we see the Black Lives Matter global network, you know, being attacked by corporate media for calling for, you know, solidarity with Cuba and calling for an end to the economic blockade there. So, I mean, at this point, you know, what do you think is the most important role that Black anti-imperialists here in the U.S. can continue to play on the global stage?
Well, I think that one thing is we have to recognize that what's happening in Africa, we have to be critical of some of the leadership and what's going on there also. When you mentioned Gaddafi, I was also reminded of there was a similar kind of experiment that was emerging in Burkina Faso. Thomas Sankara was assassinated, right?
Yes.
And then if you think back before that, you know what happened in the Congo with Lumumba. Globally, even in Africa, we have to be critical too of leadership on the continent as well and align ourselves with those legitimate movements that are struggling in those countries, you know? And so I think that that's important. We don't have a coalesced, united Black liberation movement in the United States at this point. I guess that has to be established. But we have sectors of a movement in the country that is speaking out and that is taking really important positions on international questions, like around the issue of Cuba, of Venezuela, and what's happening in other parts of Latin America. So I think that right now we have to find a common ground with some of those groups that are out there in the street that are raising these issues. There are many of us who are engaged in study right now and in practice and doing things in whatever areas that we work in. So I think for Black anti-imperialists at this point, we have to continue to be front and center. We have to continue to criticize, to speak to folk who are emerging as leaders, quote unquote, in the Black movement, particularly a lot of the Black women organizations that are emerging who are very much involved in electoral politics. You know, I think that there's a space for us as anti-imperialists in those struggles that we can't separate ourselves from them, even though many of those women's groups are one-dimensional. They're just focused on voting rights, which right now, clearly, we're under serious attack. As a radical feminist, we have to find a way to interject our viewpoints even in those movements. And we can do that. We can coalesce and we can work with them.
All right. Well, I've been speaking with Rosemary Neely. She's a veteran activist and writer, and she was an active member of the Black Panther Party and the National Alliance of Third World Women. She's an adjunct professor at the City University of New York and author of several books, including Fidel and Malcolm X, Memories of a Meeting. She was also a regular host on WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York City. Thank you so much for joining me today and speaking with me today, Rosemary.
And thank you so much, Esther. It's just wonderful to see you moving forward and continuing to do this work. And let me just put a plug out for Pacifica and where this program is being broadcast. It's very important that we support independent media, because the kinds of information that you're doing here and that's been a part of this series, you're not going to get it from Joy Reid or over MSNBC and any of the other quote-unquote liberal networks, CNN either. And I think that our voice, we need this kind of voice. Otherwise, we get crushed and people don't hear the other side and don't hear this analysis. So I just want to thank you and encourage producers to continue to put this kind of information out. It's critical, it's key, and not be intimidated by those who are emerging as a spokesperson within the media for us, with regardless of gender. Be safe now.
Seen the red sun in the autumn, and I've seen the leaves turn to golden brown. I've seen the red sun in the autumn, and I've seen the leaves be turning to golden brown. I've seen the of my people, heard them calling for freedom everywhere. If you've seen the red blood of your people, all you've got to do is reach out your hand and we'll take you there. Red stands for liberation.
This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Esther Ivarum.
Key to resisting imperialism is preserving our history of struggle and resistance. In the U.S., Filipinos and Chinese suffered greatly as workers on the transcontinental railway and as farm workers. And they also, along with other Asian Americans, resisted forced recruitment into the U.S. military. Pacifica producer Polina Vasiliev spoke with Alvin Jha, a veteran anti-imperialist activist in San Francisco, about the historical lessons of Asian American resistance to U.S. imperialism.
There were basically two periods of activism on the left among Asian Americans. The first period coincided with the Communist Party, USA activities and movements. And this is around the period of the Depression, mainly in the 30s and 40s. The people who were involved, you know, whether Chinese, Filipino, or Japanese, were essentially in these areas, cannery workers, you know, cannery workers from here all the way up to the Pacific Northwest and up to Alaska. There were merchant seamen and there were farm workers. San Francisco, there was a group called the Chinese Workers Mutual Aid Association that did labor-oriented activities. In New York, there was a group called the Chinese Hand Laundry Alliance, being advocates for the People's Republic of China. And this is actually the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Chinese Communist Party of China. Within the U.S., in the Chinese communities, the traditional organizations in Chinese communities was basically dominated by the other party, the Nationalist Party, the Kuomintang. So the so-called leftists in Chinatown were very small numbers, very great minority. After the communists won in China and established the People's Republic, a lot of the Chinese immigrants advocated for recognition of China by the U.S. And very conveniently or inconveniently, not too long after the People's Republic was established, the Korean War happened. And along with the Korean War and what the United States, or a lot of government or politicians thought happened regarding the establishment of the People's Republic was that the U.S. lost China. There was this narrative about losing China. So with the backdrop of losing China and the backdrop of the Korean War, we saw what happened with the Red Scare and Internal Security Act, which basically was persecuting possible subversives, meaning people who might be sympathetic to Red China or to Russia and that kind of view. So I do wish to point out that there was support from very prominent blacks during that time, Paul Robeson, W.E.B. Du Bois. Paul Robeson, even he went to some, I think, either rallies or meetings in San Francisco. And from my understanding, he even sang the Chinese national anthem. The second period was aligned and coincided with the new left that started in the 1960s.
What did anti-imperialism mean to you at that time?
Very simply, the people fighting the big powers who come from outside, you know, as simple as that,
yeah.
You know, without any fancy theoretical explanation, the outside powers colonized the territories in Asia, Africa, Latin America. Indigenous peoples didn't like it and fought back. And we were in alliance with that very fundamental, simple idea.
Okay, well, does that take us to the current period now?
From my personal knowledge, I don't think there are very, very many active anti-imperialist Asian American formations right now. I still go to demonstrations and stuff. I'm always very impressed by Bayan USA, by first of all, how loud they are, how outspoken they are, and mainly how anti-imperialist they are. Yes. Unapologetically anti-imperialist.
Yeah.
You know, they don't pretend to be trying to be acceptable to the mainstream Democrats or anything like that. There's another grouping that I think is fairly new. It's called the Chiao Collective. Chiao is Chinese, meaning bridge. And they call themselves an anti-imperialist media collective. I looked up their website, and I'll just quote to you what they say, just one part of it. The Chiao Collective, we seek to be a bridge between the U.S. left and China's rich Marxist anti-imperialist political work and thought in order to foster critical consideration of the role of China and socialism with Chinese characteristics in contemporary geopolitics. So I think what the Chiao Collective is trying to do is very much needed, because I see as one of the biggest problems is the so-called left, even so-called Marxists, have gone on the bandwagon of being anti-China, calling it capitalist instead of communist. And even if that's true, which I used to think, but I've had a little bit of change in thinking now that it's a process, and China had no choice but to build up their productive base. I think that kind of thinking is very prevalent in the so-called Western left right now. So I think the Chiao Collective has zeroed in on a very major problem that needs to be corrected within the Western left. And I have a personal opinion about why the Western left thinks that way. I hate to say is that the Western left is dominated probably subconsciously by ideology, even though they may not think of it that way. They think in terms of white superiority.
You're talking about the Chiao movement defining themselves as a media collective. Well, where else, if not in the media, in the arena of public opinion, isn't there that this hybrid war against China is being waged?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, the media control, the American imperialist propaganda, is more effective than anything. I think that's a very important aspect that the left needs to deal with. Make the falsehood of humanitarian imperialism more prominent.
And Alvin Jah will have the last word on our third and final installment in this series on imperialism from COVID, race, and democracy. Despite ongoing repression by the U.S. and other imperialist nations, the legacy of anti-imperialist analysis and activism lives on today, both inside the U.S. and around the globe, as a counterforce against the ravages of capitalism. This show also included music excerpts from Los Peludos, El Quinto Sol, a self-titled cut from Aslot Nation, Gil Scott-Heron Liberation Song, and Paul Robeson, March of the Volunteers. Today's show was produced by Esther Ivarum, Paulina Vosiliev, and Ken Yale. The executive producers of COVID, Race, and Democracy are Akua Holt, Paulina Vosiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all other episodes, along with our playlist and information about how to get involved, at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. I've been your host, Esther Ivarum. Thanks for listening.